Steve Bertrand. Hi, guys. Sus, it's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to Wednesday. Should be a good show. All sorts of guests. Something for everybody, Wendy, on today's show. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Today is the buffet, the radio buffet.
Yes. Yep.
I love buffets.
Yep.
We even have a sneeze guard, listeners.
We're the only radio show in Chicago that provides a sneeze guard.
Who cleans that sneeze guard?
Bill.
I come in
really?
a little bit before the show, and I clean it out. Yesterday, we were told that the weather would be a wintry mix, and just hearing the words wintry mix, it sounded to me like a cassette tape that I would play in my car. So ever since then, I kept thinking of songs, and I think the song that most suits what's going on right now would be Slip Sliding Away by Paul Simon. Would you agree?
Yes. Yesterday, I was a little worried. I had a doctor's appointment, so I was worried about driving. And driving was better than walking.
Walking was, oh my God.
It was impossible. Yeah.
The sidewalks.
Horrible.
Terrible.
Horrible.
I saw people out running yesterday.
Oh, that's
like,
brave.
What are you doing? Well, sometimes you can put those goofy things on your shoes. You know,
I needed them yesterday.
Clip-on
cleats.
Things,
yeah.
No, they're like rubber.
Yeah, they're like cleats.
Yeah,
cleats that you clip on. I needed those, man. What? I was like tiptoeing.
Yes.
And walking down the hill to the parking lot here.
Impossible.
I had to hold on to a railing though for like two blocks. I'm not kidding you. I did.
Could have seen that.
Me too.
It was very slow going.
But you know, when I was walking into the doctor's office, I honestly had to tiptoe because it was like it was really slippery.
Right.
And some dude comes busting out like, you know, I don't need anything. Totally slipped.
Did he fall?
Totally. Yeah. I'm like, are you okay? Very embarrassed and walked away.
My wife.
That the knee doctor?
No.
Would have been appropriate.
That would have. It was the hip doctor.
Oh.
No.
My wife was on her way to work, and within a few minutes of leaving our house, hit a patch of black ice and did a spin, almost a complete spin, and just went home. Just said, I cannot drive in this. It's impossible. Some parts were easier than others. Most of my ride home was pretty easy, but there were two or three patches where it was just impossible. And almost every news show led off with that footage that you've seen 1,000 times of cars spun out and in ditches and in every direction. Just horrible.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah.
And as it was coming down, it was like it was freezing rain immediately, making it slippery. You know, a lot of times
within minutes.
Yeah, within seconds.
Yeah. Horrible.
It was like ice pellets. It was really, I hate to tell you, I had great pleasure watching that man fall. He was okay. He was young. He was probably younger than I was, but he was he kind of looked at me tiptoeing like, really?
Can't navigate this?
Yeah. And then it was just like a cartoon. His feet went out from underneath him.
Yeah.
He was fine.
So
fell on his butt.
Did you stand over him for a second and just sort of look down? And
no. You know me. I was like, oh my God, are you okay?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. What? I'm fine.
Yeah.
Embarrassed.
Did he dust himself off?
Yes.
Yeah. As he got up?
Yes, he did.
Kind of
that's what you
clothing.
Do.
You're supposed to do that. Scientists tell you that's the best thing to do.
But it was like wiping a slush puppy or a Slurpee off his pants. His jeans were pretty wet.
For people who don't work here, you might not know this, but our parking situation is such where we work in one building and then the parking lot that most of us use is about 2.5 blocks away. And that walk is, as Steve pointed out, a very slippery walk. And I hit this one part where I'm crossing the street and doing it kind of quickly because cars are coming. So I go, I got to get across the street pretty quickly. And I just slide enough to make myself wonder what would happen if I fall. And I look around to make sure that nobody sees this because I look like an idiot, you know. And the only person there is our own Bennett from the show, Bennett Wakenight.
Did he help you?
No, he didn't need to help me.
Was it his corner? Because he does that crossing guard stuff.
He does extra cross guard work, which is so nice of him. After a hard shift here at the station.
Boy, he does that. You clean the sneeze guard. What do Bertrand and I do?
Well, you got to have a plan B.
I actually thought, I'm not kidding you, I thought maybe I could just glide all the way down the hill. I really thought about
like
doing that.
Like skitching.
Yeah.
That's the word I thought of, skitching.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad you didn't say skeeching.
Does Uber or Lyft provide a skitching service? I think somebody should look into that. There's money to be made there.
Yeah, by the lawyers.
I knew somebody would make money. I didn't know who.
Right, I couldn't believe how slippery it was walking. Even the dog slipped.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not supposed to slip on anything. I wonder if a cat would have slipped.
Too cool to slip.
You push it the right way.
We'll take a quick break. And then
Steve Bertrand will field the phone calls from the cat lovers.
Call Steve. Please call Steve. Yeah, absolutely.
This new year means resolutions, and we've got one you're working on twice every day. It's your oral health. And with a Quip electric toothbrush, sticking to good habits is simple.
Did you just get one in the mail, by the way?
When that's I came our refill.
In, they just sent us a refill.
Yeah.
That's so nice of them.
You can automatically sign up for that. Easy peasy.
I
hate that expression.
The guiding features are like a built-in support system for better brushing, sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums, because people brush way too hard. Some electric toothbrushes are just too abrasive.
There's a built-in two-minute timer. It pulses every 30 seconds. You think it stopped for a second until you realize what's happening, and that reminds you to switch sides and help you clean your whole entire mouth.
Up to 90% of us don't brush for the full 2 minutes that we're supposed to, or don't clean evenly. We love our Quips, no question about it. Over a million happy, healthy mouths do too. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/BillandWendy right now, you can get your first refill pack absolutely free.
We just got ours. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com, getquip.com/BillandWendy.
Are you having a physical? What are you doing?
No, I'm just grooving to the music, Bill. That's what I do.
You know, we're all very fortunate here at WGN. We all have a kind of our dream job. I love what I'm doing. I know you love what you're doing. Steve, Mary, we all do. We're very, very lucky. But there's a job opening that's just become available for somebody who wants to keep it on the back burner. Let's say for some reason radio doesn't work out. You got to have a plan B, like I said. How about this? Oscar Mayer is now accepting applications to be a Wienermobile driver.
I just saw the Wienermobile at Mariano's in Western Springs. I took a picture of it. I just texted it to you.
Isn't it strange that even as an adult, it still excites you to see the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile? Didn't you kind of get this weird flutter in your heart? Like, it's the Wienermobile. It's like seeing a celebrity. It used to be, I don't know if they still do this, but at openings of things, the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile would show up. And sometimes there was an actor, a diminutive actor, who would show up and either pretend to be Oscar Mayer himself, or maybe it was Oscar Mayer. I don't know. Do you remember this?
I don't.
He was dressed very nattily, wearing like an all-white outfit, and he would just give the wiener gum to the kids, that little chewing gum that was shaped like a hot dog.
Yeah, it was great.
He was the Frankfurter version of Chef Boyardee.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
And whistles. That's
you
what they were giving out.
Whistles,
and I'm telling you, going into Mariano's after the Wienermobile was outside, all the little kids blowing their whistles at the same time was not a fun shopping experience.
No. Also, there was a third option. You would either get the wiener gum, the wiener whistle, or they also had a ring that was made of plastic that even as a child, like I was six when I got one, it was already too small for my finger. It was shaped like a ring.
Well, you're like the Hulk.
Big fingers. I did have incredibly large fingers. It said if it was ever your childhood dream to drive the Wienermobile, was that your childhood dream? Is that a dream?
It was pretty exciting.
Just to see it was my dream. I just liked to see it. I didn't know if I wanted to drive it or not. Although, the aerodynamics of that car is fascinating to me. Just the way it's laid out, the way the windows are. I like that.
It's pretty streamlined.
Very streamlined. Probably goes 160 miles an hour, I'm guessing. You currently have no occupational or family obligations that would prevent you from finally achieving your dream. Oscar Mayer has a proposition for you. The Kraft Heinz owned company recently announced it will be taking applications for its next fleet of Wienermobile hot doggers. Those are drivers, I guess. I'm guessing. Through the end of the month. Do we know how many Wienermobiles are in their fleet?
No.
Like, as a kid, you always imagine there to be probably just one or two, but they've got dozens of them, right? Because just to make that car, if you're going to make one, you want to make a bunch of them because it's so unusual. It'd have to be very expensive to craft a car like that.
Oh, my God. They added a drone to the Wiener fleet. There's a Wiener drone.
A Wiener drone?
That would scare me.
What does that do?
Puts the mustard on the Wiener.
It does.
That flies over it. And
we are currently accepting resumes through January 31st. Oh, hurry up, everybody. For a one-year position beginning in June. This according to the announcement they posted online. The job doesn't only entail driving. According to the application, hot doggers, which they keep saying a lot of, will be tasked with acting as their own traveling public relations firm, organizing promotions, pitching TV and radio and print media, presumably with the prospect of learning more about America's favorite hot dog-shaped car. I believe America's only hot dog-shaped car. Have you ever seen another car shaped like a hot dog?
Never in my life.
Other than the Wienermobile?
By the way, there are six Wienermobiles traveling across the country with two hot doggers per mobile.
That's not a lot.
I expected more.
I thought there'd be more. But I always thought that of the Goodyear blimp. Like, didn't you think there were a lot of Goodyear blimps for a while?
Yes.
I think there's three of them, I think. I'm almost sure. Applicants should also have a BA or a BS. Steve, you have one of those, don't you?
Yeah, I do the latter, yes.
Yeah. Preferably in public relations, in journalism, communications, advertising, or marketing. Being able to speak more than one language is a plus.
See, can I just say
I speak hot dog.
We talk about this on the business lunch sometimes, this degree inflation.
Yeah.
I don't think you should have to have a degree
to drive the Wienermobile.
To drive the Wienermobile. Right?
I mean, I'm trying to think of why that would come, in handy about having a degree.
Well, you'd have to interact with people, I would imagine, but, yeah. You know, this keeps people who don't have a degree from getting jobs
right.
like this.
Right. Yeah, it shouldn't be, right? That should be open to everybody. I'm with you on this, all the way. Once hired, the company promises a competitive salary and a company car.
How competitive?
Do
they pay you in hot dogs?
They don't. Would that be the worst thing in the world?
No, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't be horrible.
But nobody wants the company car.
No. But that's what
I'd be honored to park that baby in the driveway.
But that's one of their selling points, is that you get to drive around in the company car. That's like for people who are on the fence, it's like, wow, how cool would that be to show up where I'm driving the Wienermobile all the time? That'd be great. I remember when I was in school, one of my friends applied at a McDonald's to work at a McDonald's, and they had a list of perks, and one of the top perks was own your own uniform. Is that a perk?
Well, because
to wear a McDonald's outfit, you can't. Other than working at McDonald's, where could you show up wearing a McDonald's uniform?
Did they share them?
No, yeah. But that means you didn't have to buy clothes for work, so that took a lot of money off your plate.
I guess, but that it wouldn't entice me to work there. Like, oh, won't that be cool? Oh, my own McDonald's uniform.
All right, Carrie wants to talk to us. Wienermobile talk. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, guys. I lived in, I'm back in Illinois now, but lived in Madison for work, Wisconsin, for about 18 years. And until very recently, that's where the Oscar Mayer plant was, which was really cool because when you drove by, it smelled like hot dogs. It was awesome. It was right by the airport. But that's where they would park the Wienermobile.
Oh, cool.
And they had, so we'd see them all the time. I want to say they had like 6 or 8. And that was a really big deal to be one of the, I think they call them ambassadors. It was a really big deal to get one of those jobs. It was like a really good internship kind of a thing. And it was a huge competition. They were everywhere with the whistles. So we just kind of got used to it, but it would still give me that little kid flutter when I'd see them.
Where did you say you saw them, though?
In Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Madison, Wisconsin. Yeah, that's where the Oscar Mayer factory was until they just closed very recently, and they moved somewhere.
Paul Ryan was a Wienermobile driver.
Oh, was he?
Still is.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal to be a Wiener, to get one of those jobs.
Sure.
I guess on your resume, that's really, believe it or not, really cool, I guess.
Well, it's an elite job.
It's an elite job, and no one's saying it, but you get a lot of ladies.
Oh, I'm driving that thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Absolutely.
Carrie, thank you so much. We appreciate you strolling down memory lane. I got very excited when I saw it out in front of Mariano's.
Yes.
I'm just proud of you guys for not doing any mustard or ketchup.
No, it's too easy.
Relish, nothing.
Too easy.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce to you a former Wienermobile hot dogger. This is Katie. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
Katie, when did you drive the Wienermobile? I never thought I'd ask a person that question.
Oh, my gosh, it's an honor. I drove the Wienermobile right out of college. I got a communication degree in, like, 94, 95.
Yeah.
And I drove the first Canadian Wiener.
Oh, congratulations.
So thank you. They just started selling the product in Canada. And they had a fleet here. Everybody grew up knowing the Wienermobile. But they had just launched the Canadian program. So my territory was Western Canada. You see the Wienermobile, everybody knows who you are. So I was tasked with driving the giant hot dog in Western Canada. But when I got there, so some weren't as familiar with it, but it was a lot of fun.
No. I thought in Canada they had a back bacon boat. Am I imagining that? I thought they did.
Is it true that
hung up on us?
Yeah, I would do
a picture of Joey Chestnut on the dashboards of all the automobiles, like automatic turnaround.
That's Nathan's. That's a big difference.
Oh, right.
It says, as I looked up,
she really did hang up on us. By the way,
she did.
I know.
How much does a hot dogger make?
Yes.
The hot doggers can't say how much they make, but a company spokesman confirmed that they earn a little more than the average salary of college graduates in 2012.
Yeah.
Now, these are old statistics. According to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, about $44,000 a year, and that was from 2013.
So it is competitive. It's not bad.
That's pretty good. I mean,
right.
So that shows that they do more. They're more of a PR job or things like that.
Sure.
I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right.
It's a brand ambassador slash hot dogger, which is what I want on my business card. I don't know about you.
You can't go wrong with that on your resume. We'll take a break. Steve will give you the news. And then the great Joyce Boulafont joins us. I'm not kidding. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Wow, that's a tall, skinny, long microphone you have there, Bill.
When you play this theme song, Wendy, only a tall, skinny microphone will do. Joyce Boulafont joins us right now. Joyce, I have to be honest, normally what would happen with Wendy and I as we're introducing a guest is we would list their credits, but in your case, it's actually easier to mention the shows that you haven't been on. How are you? It's so good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. The music scared me to death. I thought, where am I supposed to be at the studio?
You're supposed to be sitting next to Charles Nelson Reilly right around now.
Right, exactly.
Joyce Boulafont was on pretty much every television show that you grew up with in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and beyond. I think, Joyce, most people would probably know you, if not for Match Game, as Murray Slaughter's wife, Marie, on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I did that a lot. It was such a popular show. But as you said, I was all over the place.
Everywhere.
I mean, we were looking at it. You were on Gunsmoke. You were on My Three Sons.
Bonanza.
One of our favorite shows, Love American Style.
Yep.
I miss that. They should bring that back.
Yes, that was fun.
Wagon Train. The Virginian, Perry Mason. I mean, seriously, where do we stop?
I know. It was fun. What I can say is I was a very lucky actress. I really was. I left the minute I graduated from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, I went right into a Broadway show, and then I just kept going full steam ahead. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful life.
Joyce, you've written a book called My Four Hollywood Husbands, and we'll talk about it because it's a very, very diverse group of gentlemen that you've been married to over the years. But go back to Mary Tyler Moore Show for just a little bit, because I think most people, if you enjoy sitcoms on TV, you have to agree that's one of the best of all time. Did you know while you were making it how amazing that show would be for generations to follow?
I don't know about for generations, but the writing was so far superior to anything, and I think that's what made it so good. I mean, all the cast was wonderful, but it was just the writing was so good that each week that we'd sit around the table and read the script, we'd laugh and look. I mean, it was so much fun to do. It really was.
And it was such a monumental show for young women that it was okay not to be married and to go out and start their careers. That's what I loved about it. And I was just a little girl then.
Oh, well, good for you. You got the message? And get married.
Joyce, you are...
I did both.
Yeah, you can do it.
I have to tell you, looking at you as Murray's wife, you know, we got to know this rough and tumble Murray, but at home, I mean, you were just the sweet woman. You reminded me much of my mother.
Oh, well, thank you. It was a lovely character to do. And I was sad because I was a reoccurring character. I wasn't on every week. Because I was doing all those other shows, and so I'd come back and forth, which was kind of fun because I would notice each time I came back, the cast had become more of the character they were playing, especially Ted Knight. He was so funny.
Hysterical.
He really became that character.
Yep. We're talking with Joyce Boulafont, who is in every television show ever created. Joyce, you're the center of two casting triangles that amaze me. I'll share them with you. You're probably well aware of them already. But on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you played Gavin McLeod's wife, Marie. You also played Jill Whelan's mother in the movie Airplane, but then Jill Whelan played Gavin McLeod's daughter on The Love Boat. Kind of strange, right?
And now Gavin and I are playing next door neighbor. We live in the same neighborhood, and we do a lot of benefits for different charities in the valley here in the desert, where it's very warm and beautiful. I don't want to rub it in, but I heard your weather report.
Yeah.
But so we get to see each other all the time, which is great fun.
Now here's the stranger one. Also on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you played the mother, the adopted mother of Robbie Rist. He played your son David on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then you played his wife on Big John Little John.
All right, Bill has way too much time on his hands. Have you figured this out, Joyce?
No, my gosh, I forgot about that.
That's kind of weird. Yeah.
It is. Well, my whole life has been wonderfully weird. It's been, the title of my book, My Four Hollywood Husbands, which I absolutely said, no, that's a terrible title. I don't want to do that. A friend had suggested it. And I said, that's terrible. That's so tacky. But then I thought about it, and I said, yeah, but it might sell books, and it is.
Yes. It tells the story. It's so the four men that you were married to, the four Hollywood men, because there's a fifth husband in there also, such a diverse group. Can we do this? We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk about those four Hollywood husbands that Joyce Boulafont has had.
Can I just jump in with a Robbie Rist thing? Didn't he play Oliver, Cousin Oliver, on the Brady Bunch? Didn't you almost get that role? Of Carol Brady?
Yes, I not almost got it. I had it. And I was signed, sealed, and delivered as Mrs. Brady.
And what
happened? How about
happened?
That?
All of a sudden, just a few days before we were going to start shooting, ABC in New York, Marty Starker was the president then, all of a sudden, Florence Henderson became available, and they just wanted her desperately, and on the West Coast, they wanted me, and it was a real struggle, but it all turned out the way it should. Florence was wonderful, and I had my own real live Brady Bunch of eight children, so it all turns out the way it's supposed to.
That's a very positive attitude. I don't think a lot of people would have that.
I would not have that
attitude. No, me neither. Good for you, Joyce. Joyce Boulafont is our guest. We'll take a break and then more discussion next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. You make it on your own. This is Bill Laff. It's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Joyce Boulafont, one of TV's most prolific actresses of all time. She has written a book called My Four Hollywood Husbands. Joyce, let's start out with husband number one, James MacArthur, who most people would know from Hawaii Five-0.
Yes, and all the Disney films he did, too. We went to school together. I met him when I was 14. We started going steady when I was 16, and we were married right before we were 20. And had 9 years married and two wonderful children.
And he is the son of the First Lady of Theater, Helen Hayes, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And Helen and I were very, very close. I called her Mom, and I even do a one-woman show called Remembering Helen Hayes with Love, because our relationship was so close and tumultuous also, but it was a wonderful relationship.
Well, it's got to be pressure-filled for you. You're acting, and your mother-in-law is, like I said, the First Lady of Theater. You don't get much bigger than the First Lady of Theater, right?
That's right. That's right. But I didn't know her that way. I met her when I was very young, and I didn't know that she was such a big deal.
Yeah.
And when Jimmy took me to see her in a play, I was amazed.
Husband number two was Edward Mallory, who most people would know. He was a soap opera actor for the most part, Days of Our Lives, right, for years.
Yes, he played Dr. Bill Horton, and we were married for 7 years, and we had a son, John, who was later adopted by my third husband. Isn't this confusing? You know, I just wanted to be married once in my life to one person with a picket fence and little children running around. And look what happened. But the book, I know you want to go through the husbands, and then I'll tell you what happened.
All right. I just wonder if Elizabeth Taylor ever called you and said, hey, ease up a little bit. I've got the record. I don't want you to try to beat my record.
No, but I do have to tell you something funny. I did get, Lillian Gish was a very good friend of mine, my fairy godmother. I talk about her in my book. And when I was getting divorced the second time, I called her, and I just hated to tell her because she was like an angel on this earth, just mm-hmm. the sweetest, most beautiful person. And I said, oh, Lillian, I just hate telling you this, but I'm getting divorced again. And I was just ready for this long lecture. And she said, oh, darling, she said, maybe you're like I am. She said, maybe you're not meant to be married.
Oh.
She said, just do what I do. Love them and leave them.
Solid advice, Joyce. Great advice.
No, I thought if you wanted to go to bed with somebody, you had to marry them, for goodness sake.
Your next Hollywood husband was William Asher, who most people would know as a writer and director on everything from I Love Lucy, you name it. He was involved in it. Bewitched was his baby, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And he was married to the wonderful Elizabeth Montgomery, and I got to have three wonderful stepchildren when I married Bill. That's when I had the Brady Bunch, and we were eight children, and two of his boys lived with us, and Rebecca would come on weekends, and we had more fun together, and that was a marriage that lasted 20 years, and I'll explain all of what happened after you talk about the love of my life.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because Roger Perry was one of the most likable actors I ever saw ever, and he was married to you just up until that. We lost him, sadly, about a year ago, but talk about Roger Perry and that marriage.
Well, that was just heaven on earth. We had met in 1962, and there was this unspoken chemistry bond energy between us. It was never discussed because I was married to Jimmy at the time, and he was separated. And it was just never discussed. But then years later, in 1967, when Jim and I were getting divorced, we started dating. And he then broke up with me after a year. But that's when I got even with him and married one of his best friends,
oh.
Deb Mallory. and then in 2000, I had that very brief 2-month marriage, which should have been annulled and not called a marriage. And he was divorcing Joanne Worley that he'd been married to for 25 years. We got together. The timing was unbelievable. And we were very, very scared about dating each other after all these years.
Sure.
And all of this fantasy going on. And so we would just go to the movies and get hot dogs, and that was about it. Until we really fell in love again and were married in 2002.
But isn't that something? You called him... He's the love of your life, and you were married for... It took you that long and go through that many people to finally find him, but you found him. That's a miracle, isn't it?
It was, and you know what? We'd look at each other, and sometimes at dinner we'd say grace and hold hands and look at each other and go, we're a miracle, aren't we? We have so much to be grateful for. And every day now I walk in that gratefulness that we had such an incredible love. And it's the saddest thing ever that's happened to me. I'm trying to write a book about Roger's passing and my taking care of him and what I've learned about how to help someone that you love make that transition. Because I think I learned so much that I want to share with other people that could be helpful. So the new book is called I Loved Him to Death.
Oh, wonderful.
And when is that going to be out, or is it out already, Joyce?
It's on my computer right now. I'm having a little bit of a difficult time as I'm reliving it all, but it's because it's still such a deep sadness.
Of course.
And I'm sure it will always be, but I feel that energy that was unspoken when we first met, that has just it's still there. And wherever his energy is gone, mine is, it's connected still.
Yep.
And a lot of people are finding themselves in that same situation, so this will help a lot of people. Please keep in touch with us when that book comes out. It was just such a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. And you stay warm there. You ought to come visit me in California.
We can leave at 3:30 today.
Bill will take you up on that.
Yeah, there's a flight at 3:30 today. I'll be out there.
Okay.
I'll be husband number five, Joyce. I'm ready.
Come on, you're married already. You know,
I'm not. Oh, you're married. Okay.
I'm married. Yeah.
I don't do married people.
All right.
She seemed interested, though,
for a minute. I had you for a minute. Joyce, thank you for all the work you've done over the years. Honestly, you've made us laugh. You've made us cry. We love seeing you on TV, and it's such a thrill to talk to you. Continued success to you.
Well, thank you very much.
It's Joyce Boulafont, everybody. Her website is joyceboulafont.com. Her book is My Four Hollywood Husbands. Have a great rest of the week, Joyce. Thanks again.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Please keep in touch. She is on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook as well. Joyce Boulafont Official. You can figure out how to spell the name.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spell it for you. You can just Google her.
You think when you were 11 years old.
Never.
Day, yeah.
Never. When I would be watching her on a TV show, I never thought there'd be a time I'd be talking to her one day, suggesting that I stay at her place.
I love your wife, but I'm telling you right now, if you weren't married, you would be husband number five. And there'd be a book about you.
Yes.
We could get some press for this show,
finally.
For God's sake.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it? We'll take a break, and then there's more of us, Bill and Wendy, on WGN. Still left, but it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Dr. John Duffy, clinical psychologist and frequent guest and host here at WGN Radio. The podcast, John, is called Better?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, it's you and your wife, Julie, together?
Yes. Yes, and our latest one is on what we talked about last week, vaping and juuling. It's a great one, and so I recommend it.
Excellent, yeah. Excellent.
You don't recommend vaping and juuling.
I do not recommend vaping and juuling. Thank you, Wendy, and my commas need to be more carefully placed.
Well, I'll tell you, everybody is so quick to judge on the text line, so I'm here to sort of protect you, because when we've been talking about this Native American 16-year-old, all the different groups, the story changes every minute, it seems.
Oh, yeah.
And it has been, I guess we are all seeing what we want to see. I want to apologize because at first I saw something that wasn't really it. But as all the facts come out, I'm still not happy with anyone involved in this.
I feel the same way. It's a really, really fascinating story for right now, right? Because it's kind of the culmination of a lot of things, right? Because if we have this kind of inherent mindset, we can find our villains. Right. So
yeah.
If you are left leaning, you're going to find your villains very easily.
Yeah.
If you're right leaning, you can find your villains very easily. And so the people who are less quick to judge, I find it just in the last couple of days, are young people who are a little more discerning. I worked with more people Monday and Tuesday, and I said, wow, can you believe the way these kids behaved? And most kids were like, yeah, we'll see. You know, they
really?
they were kind of like recognizing, and they were really leaning on like, if you look at Reddit and you look at Snapchat and you look at some other stuff that we see online, you realize almost every story, when you first see it, it looks like it's something, and then it morphs
of
into
course.
Something else. So you wait it out, and you see what the reality is. Whereas the rest of us, including, you know, the Washington Post, is quick to say, to jump on this and say, I think we get what happened here, and so we're going to report on it, you know? So I have a couple thoughts about this. One is that no matter who you want to vilify here, there's an element of groupthink, right? You know, where if it were just one person from each group that was debating on the mall, we wouldn't hear about it. But there's these huge groups, and they're kind of acting in concert. And we were talking a moment ago about some of the kids from that Catholic high school.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were all in, right, on the chant, and it looked like they were trying to take this guy down,
yeah.
You know. But there were a few kids in the fringes who looked uncomfortable.
Yes,
to me,
they did.
Right?
And they just participated to be part of the group.
Yeah, right? Because this
and
is...
And not wholeheartedly.
Right. Because imagine if you go against the group, you know, what happens to you socially.
Mm-hmm.
But if one of those kids had said, hey, guys, let's not do this right now, I do wonder whether we would have had a dissipated situation and we wouldn't be talking about this all week at all.
But it takes a special kind of kid, especially a kid. As an adult, it's difficult, but it's harder as a kid to stand up to a group of people, supposedly your peers, and go, let's not make a mistake.
It does.
And especially now.
Yes.
Now there is so much hatred. There have been people saying the MAGA hat did not help the situation. There are Donald Trump supporters who say, why shouldn't you wear a MAGA hat? People see it. They know where you stand right away.
Right.
And if they're not standing the same way, they're going to start a verbal war. That's what's
Absolutely.
Happening. Same thing if somebody wore a Hillary Rocks hat.
Right.
Someone who was against that would say, yeah, you lost. I mean,
right.
It's just a sparking point, isn't it?
Right, right. It's an impetus for confrontation, no matter what. We were talking about, like, if you wear an Aaron Rodgers jersey into a Northside bar, you know, you're going to have a problem.
Right.
You're looking for it. You're creating that circumstance. But this is serious, right?
Don't you think you should be able to, this will sound like I'm defending the opposite side that I believe, but it's your right to wear whatever you want
right.
to wear.
You're right, Bill.
Jersey-wise, message-wise. Yes, you do know deep down this is going to aggravate some people, but it's a conversation starter.
Right? In fact, you could argue that if there were three groups there, which it appears
there
that there were,
yeah.
They all have a right to do precisely what they did,
yes.
right? You know, you might not agree with their methodology,
yeah.
but in terms of, like, what America is about, this is free speech on the Capitol steps, you know, like,
right.
maybe you could make an argument that, well, this is the right thing that happened.
Yeah.
People expressed themselves, and there was no violence, and the only fallout resulted from the fact that there were cameras there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that kind of throws me, is that every single person there is aware that there are 30 different cameras trained on them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it begs the question to me, not about, like, where do I stand in terms of ideology or politics or something, but, you know, looking forward, I think maybe the question we want to ask ourselves if we end up in situations like this, and I think more and more we're going to, is who do I want to be in this moment? You
yeah.
know what I mean? How do I want to present myself, not just from a branding point of view, but also from a deep integrity point of
sure,
view?
Sure,
of course.
You
know, who do I want to seem like, you
right.
know?
It's interesting you say that, because I was wondering, what if this weekend there was some high school group, just you pick the group, you pick the cause, randomly at an event, would they do things a little bit differently after they watched things play out this past week?
It's a great question. I would guess that there's a little bit of a recoiling, a little bit of a backlash, like, ooh, yeah, I don't know if I want to
yeah.
get stuck in that storm that these guys have been stuck in, regardless of fault.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think we learn with experience.
Why aren't people going hard on the black kids with the words they chanted? I don't know that they were kids, first and foremost. And second of all, I can't say this because I can't predict the future or what might have happened, but I don't know. Would this have happened if there weren't MAGA hats involved? Somebody says, are you going to blame Donald Trump for everything? No, not everything. But, I mean, now Nick Sandman he's gone viral.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of the goal of every kid these days?
You do think about the potential to be the next Ben Shapiro
in a
situation
like
this, right?
The comparison, John, that we got over the text line several times was David Hogg, one of the Parkland
sure.
survivors, and I don't think that's accurate.
What about?
Yeah,
that comparison is unfair. David Hogg was in a school where his classmates were shot to death,
yeah.
and he was coming forward saying, please stop guns. I saw my friends die in the hallways of my school.
Yeah.
And did he become famous for it? He did become famous for it, but for a very clear-cut message. This kid he's a message maker for all the wrong reasons.
I would agree.
That standoff, as opposed to being in a hallway where you're watching kids get shot to death, that's not the same thing.
I actually agree with you wholly, and as you're speaking, I'm thinking, and this is probably an important way to think. I'm thinking, am I thinking ideologically, or do I agree wholly? And I actually agree wholly. I do think David Hogg was kind of accidentally
yeah.
thrust into this horrible situation,
yeah.
right? Where he decided, okay, well, I have this opportunity for activism. I suddenly have a platform.
Right.
I'm going to use this. I don't think that was this
Nick
other young
Sandman's
man's
idea.
No, I don't think this was this plan. You know,
he is also an accidental celebrity. There's no question about
absolutely.
It. The day before, he wasn't going, I bet in a day or two my face will be all over the internet.
No,
I don't think so.
No.
And you have to figure out why somebody, listen, if you want to wear a MAGA hat, like, you're right, Bill, it's your prerogative.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And, but you have to think about things as well. When we, I've been a White Sox fan my whole life. I know this is on a much smaller scale, but when this radio station was, hosting the Cubs, I kind of felt like, you know what? I don't know if I want to wear my Sox jersey here.
Right. Right.
You got to think about the audience.
And it's all a matter of scale. But you're right. The MAGA hat, for regardless of how you feel, you can't deny the fact that that is a stimulus, right, for people. That's going to activate people one way or another. You're either going to get a, you know, yeah, man, you go, or you're going to get a, you know, how dare you, you know. And there are certain assumptions that a lot of people are making based on the fact that you are wearing that hat. And I think we all know that those assumptions are being made.
Right.
Yeah.
Why is it hard for some of us, myself included, I'll put myself at the forefront of this, we got that first burst of video about the standoff between the two.
Yeah.
And then we heard different stories. Oh, you're not seeing the whole thing. You got to watch more. And I watched more. And even after watching more, I still didn't like this Nick Sandman kid.
Right.
I still, even after there was more evidence, I'm still like, no, there's something about his attitude that's not quite right. He's not the hero they're painting him to be.
So I think it's two things. One is, one is probably the look on his face, right?
Yeah.
You have this visceral reaction to this smug look on his face. And, you know, and I think most of us can read faces pretty well and recognize, does this look like somebody who's trying to diffuse a situation or ignite a situation,
right?
And that smugness, even if it still feels like a dare.
Well, he says he was silently praying during that.
He was not.
It's hard to buy, right?
But I am an apologist for teenagers because I have two teenage boys. Put in a position against an adult like that, perhaps you don't know how to act either, and you don't want to back down, and you don't want to be rude, so you don't know what to do. That could be as well. But he was not praying. That
didn't
I know
like
for
it.
Sure.
Right, right, right. There's also the confirmation bias idea, right? We have this idea going in of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. This is part, of, I think, of a cultural problem. And a lot of us decided immediately that's one of the bad guys. And
yeah.
You can see it. And the initial videotape suggested that,
right?
What was released initially.
The eyes are the window to the soul.
Wendy, right? I'm going to write that down. Hold on. Can you say that again slower? Hold on.
Well, really. And look at this kid's eyes. And he may be a little nervous. He was thrust into this position. And I'm still mad at these chaperones. That's why I honestly never wanted to be a chaperone, because it's a lot of responsibility that I don't feel these chaperones they took for a good reason.
It's
they didn't do it.
I think that's a great point, and I don't know if we train chaperones now for what they're going to be confronted with and what their responsibilities are. And to your point, Wendy, these are children, right? They are learning their identity and their place in the world. So a lot of them grew up under a certain mindset, and that may change and morph over time, but we can't entirely blame them for adopting something that's all they've been exposed to probably the vast majority of their lives.
So true.
Yeah.
John, thanks for being here.
Thanks
really appreciate
me,
it. It's Dr. John Duffy. Again, the podcast is called Better. Just go to WGM Plus. It's located there. When's your next time on the airwaves here?
I was going to be on the 8th, but I think that might be changing, so I will let you know.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
We'll keep
thanks,
everybody
John.
Posted. Yeah. Thanks, John. News is next, and then more of Bill and Wendy on WGN. Eric, thanks so much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Thrilled that you're listening. We're at 312-981-7200 if you'd like to contact us at any point during the show. This, 2019, is the 30th anniversary of the execution of Ted Bundy, one of the most chilling serial killers in American history. Dr. Daryl Turner, a clinical and forensic psychologist, is on right now to talk about this milestone. Dr. Turner, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
For people who are not familiar with the Ted Bundy case, and a lot of time has passed, those killings started way back in the mid-70s, 1974. Go through some of the paces of Ted Bundy and what he did, please.
Sure. So there's some speculation that his killings actually started in the late 60s. He evidenced some really odd, violent behavior as a child, which is not uncommon for people who develop into psychopaths and sadistic serial killers. But Ted Bundy was prolific in his hunting and in his killing. He had over 30 confirmed victims, and he made statements near the end of his life that it was well over 200 victims. He offended across many states. He was arrested in Utah. He escaped from jail. He was rearrested after a time. He re-escaped from jail. And he ended, his last murders were in Florida, at a Chi Omega house where he killed several co-ed students and kidnapped, and did some pretty horrible things to a 13-year-old girl there in Florida as well, where he was ultimately, convicted after he represented himself in court at trial. And as you said, was executed in 1989. That's kind of a nutshell for you.
Dr. Turner, people have said over the years that because he was a fairly charming individual and a decent-looking man, that that may have played a role in him being a free man for as long as he was. Do you buy that or not?
I absolutely buy that. One of the interesting things to me about the Ted Bundy case is that this was the first time that the American psyche had sort of been hit with this notion that, wow, this is really the guy next door. This is someone that your daughter could meet at college and bring home and you'd be very impressed. He's well-spoken. He's charismatic. He was on a gubernatorial campaign. He was a law student. As you said, he was a good-looking guy. People that met him liked him. And it was sort of this notion when it came out what he had done, what he was capable of, that, wow, these serial killers aren't necessarily these hunched back individuals that are drooling on themselves in the streets, screaming at the sky, howling at the moon. These are everyday people. And what Bundy showed was, you know, unfortunately, the more conning and manipulative and charismatic someone is, the more successful they can be at going undetected while committing these types of crimes.
And forensics it's probably way better now than it was, but there were some breakthroughs that helped with this case at that time, correct?
Absolutely. The lead detective is a guy named Robert Keppel, and he was the head of the Ted Task Force, as they called it. Someone overheard him using the name Ted. So they, when he was picking up victims at Lake Sammamish, he picked up two victims in one day. So they knew that it was either an alias or that it was his actual name. So there was a few other things that they knew. They knew about the Volkswagen Beetle. They knew that he was going to have been a psychology student at UW at one point. They knew a few things, but they were just inundated with tips, people calling and saying, I think it's my husband, I think it's my principal, I think it's the guy that works at the gas station, whatever. And so this was the first time that there was an actual computer program used in solving a case of this magnitude. And they would put the information from the tips that they would get into this computer program. And you can imagine back then this computer's the size of a room, you know.
Yeah.
What it slowly did was it sorted through all of the tips that they got, and it spit out, you know, a very, very small stack as compared to the thousands and thousands that they were getting of suspects that they had received tips on that met all of these different criteria. And one of the neat things that Detective Keppel has said is that even if Bundy had not been apprehended in Utah, for driving around with his lights off in a neighborhood and smoking marijuana, and then they found a rape kit, and that led to all this, that he was actually one of the next in that small stack that the computer had spit out because he met all of the criteria that they were looking for. So Detective Keppel's pretty firm in his belief that the task force would have gotten him pretty soon, despite the fact that he was picked up in Utah. And I've just always thought that's such a fascinating aspect of the Bundy case that not many people know about. It was the first time that this sort of advanced technology was used in apprehending him.
And you mentioned that Volkswagen Beetle, the 1968, there is an exhibit in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, at the Alcatraz East Crime Museum. It has the 1968 Volkswagen Beetle on view. There are letters, cards, photos, and a radio given to Bundy by his mother that he kept until he was moved to death row. This is a limited time. I have to ask, as intriguing as it is, who's going to go see this?
I would tell you a lot of people would go see that.
The morbid curiosity, I guess.
There absolutely is a morbid curiosity. I think it's to be kind, I think it's a disbelief among humans that another human being could do such horrible things. I really think that's what it is. I don't think that there's any kind of an attraction to those behaviors or anything other than just, holy cow, that someone that lives and breathes, that shakes hands and goes to the grocery store could do these things. Now, he did have his fans. He did have his groupies. He was married during his trial in Florida, and that's a known phenomenon is, women who seek out the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, Scott Peterson, even one of his jurors has turned into one of these people that regularly writes him and communicates with him now.
The Menendez brothers.
Exactly. Right? So there's a very, yes, yes. So there's a small subset where I think it goes beyond morbid curiosity into something else. But that's a very, very small yet extremely interesting subset.
Well, Dr. Turner, it's a 1-2 punch. It's one, I can't believe a guy could be that evil, that hateful, that much of a monster. But there's that second part where you go, I can't believe I could be fooled by a guy like that. That somebody who seems to be so normal could really be just the opposite, right?
That's absolutely true. And I think that, we all are guilty of watching these documentaries and things on people like Charles Manson or David Koresh or Ted Bundy. And we all sit there and go, oh, these idiots, I would never fall for that. But the truth is that I think that we're all a lot more susceptible than we think that we are. And again, not to be repetitive, but the better someone is at being a psychopath, the better they are at being manipulative and being charming, the lower our inhibitions go and the lower our guard goes, especially a guy like Bundy, who's a good-looking guy.
Yeah, how about that? Dr. Daryl Turner is our guest. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. But first, you spend about a third of your life in your sheets, so if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, better sleep is a wonderful place to start. New year, new you, new sheets. Brooklinen has over 500,000 happy sleepers and counting. Join that movement today. Brooklinen works directly with the manufacturers and then passes the savings on to you, making luxury bedding, but without those luxury prices. Finally, you can get 5-star hotel quality sheets without breaking your bank. My Brooklinen sheets are by far the best, most comfortable sheets that I've ever slept on. Now it's time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer only for our listeners, though. You'll get $20 off and free shipping just by using the promo code BILL at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident that all their sheets, their comforters, and their towels come with a lifetime warranty. But the only way to get your $20 off and free shipping is by using the promo code BILL, my name Bill, at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com, BROOKLINEN.com. The promo code's BILL, Brooklinen. These really are the best sheets ever.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we're talking Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy is all over the place. There is a Netflix documentary that has dropped, or I think it has dropped, Conversations with Ted Bundy. Then there's a new movie where Zac Efron will be playing Ted Bundy. And we are talking to Dr. Daryl Turner right now, clinical and forensic psychologist. Did you help on this case at all, Doctor?
I did not help on this case at all. This case was before my time, unfortunately. It would have been a very interesting one to be a part of, though, however.
You've worked on similar cases. Are there a lot of commonalities in the personalities that we meet in doing a case like this?
There are. You're going to be dealing when someone is able to repeatedly do these things to victims, whether they're female or male. It's a little closer to home. You guys with John Wayne Gacy there had a series of male victims. You're going to be dealing with someone with a psychopathic personality. And someone with a psychopathic personality, there are going to be commonalities among all of them. These are going to be people that can be quite gregarious and outgoing and people that can, be very, very slick and pull you in just a couple of minutes and
and verbally facile people, but they're also very, very shallow people. There's not a lot under the surface. After about 5 minutes with these people, you kind of start to get the, you know, something's not quite right here feeling from them. Pathological liars, people that tend to live off of the good graces of other people, people that are callous and that can't empathize with other people, people that lack remorse for their actions. So there's this whole series of personality traits that when they're present and when there's a deviant sexual interest, which is the case in all of these guys, then you're going to have a lot of similarities. Now, sometimes you may have a psychopath that has no deviant sexual interest, so you just have someone like Bernie Madoff or some of our politicians or CEOs or people that are willing to kind of step on people and stab people in the back in order to get where they need to go and do so without remorse. But it's when you have that combination of the sexually deviant interests and the psychopathy, that's when you're dealing with a really dangerous individual.
Why mostly men? Can't women be psychopaths too? As I ask, I thought I'd never ask that question ever.
Is there a glass ceiling on psychopaths? That's one of these questions.
I'm serious.
It is not. It's not a PC phenomenon, unfortunately. No. You know, there are female psychopaths, absolutely. But we just don't find the connection between sex and violence and the predatory nature among females in the same way that we do among males. So if you look at Eileen Wuornos, she's considered a serial killer, but she was really killing for money. She was killing out of, I think, anger and revenge for the amount of times that she was raped as a prostitute. She wasn't gaining, there's no indication that she was gaining sexual gratification from shooting these Johns that she was killing. So the nexus or the connection between the sadistic urges, the inflicting pain and humiliation on a sexual partner, and in the case of some of these people, not to get too dark on your program, but a sexual attraction to people who are actually deceased, that is something that we tend to see more among males than we do on females. I don't think we quite understand why that is yet. It's just kind of how we're hardwired.
Dr. Turner, in your opinion, most of these people that qualify as psychopaths and serial killers, do they have the ability to stop if they want to, or is the compulsion just too strong?
I think they absolutely have the ability to stop. I think that one of the things that we have learned is that some of our previous notions are simply not true. You know, it was just widely believed that these guys will go until they're caught, and they ramp up, and they escalate in their degree of violence, and they either, if they stop, it's because they died or because they went to prison.
Yeah.
And then we see cases like BTK or the Green River Killer, where they go decades without doing anything. And one of the things that we learned from Ted Bundy in his conversations with detectives about the nature of these types of offenders is that we tend to think of them as these sort of supervillains, you know, like some kind of Batman villain that's sitting in a lair trying to think how to play tricks on police and things like that. But these are people with families and jobs, and they have injuries, and they get hospitalized, and they move, and they have a normal life in addition to this horrible pattern of behavior that they're engaging in.
Go on.
No, I was just going to say, so they absolutely, not only can they stop, but they do stop.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. Also, you know, quite simply, as these people age out, so in the case of BTK, he wasn't caught until fairly recently. He was relatively older, much more so than when he was killing.
Sure.
And we see these urges tend to just kind of wane out a little bit as these people age. You know, other things become more important. We have health issues. I mean, you can think about your own sex drive. I know it's hard to do to compare the two, but, you know, your sex drive at 20 is very different from what it is at 70.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you have a book out, Doctor? Because you are just really fascinating. Clinical and forensic psychologist Dr. Daryl Turner.
No, I have a website, and I'm working on an instrument right now that detects deception among sexual predators. And I would like to write a book one day when I'm retired, but right now there's just a bit too much work going on for that.
TurnerForensicsPsychology.com, is that where we send people?
That's where you send people. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. Thank you for all the information. Really fascinating.
Yeah, it was great talking to you all.
Thanks, Dr. Turner. Have a good rest of the week. Dr. Daryl Turner, clinical and forensic psychologist, talking about the 30th anniversary of Ted Bundy's execution. Well, Wendy, we did it on today's show. We talked about Joyce Boulafont and Ted Bundy. Mission accomplished. Coming up, tune into the stream. Hear us talk about what's hot and what's cold at the Academy Awards. We'll tell you the story about the movie nominated for an Oscar that there's now a petition to get off the ballot.
What?
Yep, it's true.
Is it Green Book?
I can't. No.
I know you love that.
No.
I know, but there's some pushback on Green Book.
There is some pushback on Green Book. This is separate. It's all sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling. They're the 60 Minute Men.